Hello and welcome to Fixing Healthcare, a weekly podcast on American medicine. I am Jeremy Corr, host of the popular New Books and Medicine podcast and CEO of Executive Podcast Solutions. With me is Dr. Robert Pearl. For 18 years, Robert led the Permanente Medical Group, the nation's largest physician group. He's a healthcare contributor at Forbes.com, a best-selling author, and a professor at both the Stanford University School of Medicine and Business. His upcoming book, ChatGPT MD, on the impact generative AI will have in healthcare will be published next month. All profits will be donated to Doctors Without Borders. Information on a broad range of medical topics can be found on his website, robertpearlmd.com, and on his monthly musings published the second Tuesday of every month. With the new book going to the printer today, I thought it would be fitting for you to read one of the chapters from your latest book, Uncaring, How the Culture of Medicine Kills Doctors and Patients.
In the southwestern corner of Brooklyn, along the banks of the Hudson River, there once stood a magnificent wall. Densely constructed with brick and stone, it was erected by Army engineers not long after the War of 1812. By order of Congress, soldiers lined the wall with two tiers of cannons. They called it Fort Hamilton, after the American military hero and statesman. This wall and many like it along the eastern seaboard guarded against the naval fleets of foreign enemies. It served its purpose well, so well in fact, that as wars came and went, the fleets of enemy ships never arrived, never even dared to test the wall. By the 20th century, wars were being fought in the skies, and the thick armored wall along the Hudson River no longer served as a barrier against the next generation of threats. Before long, Fort Hamilton was turned into a processing center for troops shipping out to Europe. Today, the wall serves no military function at all. Instead, it serves as a guardian of history. Every day at 10 a.m., the heavy wooden doors swing open, inviting people into New York City's only military museum. Inside, visitors move about freely, exploring the cavernous exhibits, learning about the antiquity of our nation's harbor defenses. Some walls come down and some walls stay standing. This wall, which once kept enemies out, now welcomes everyone in. Now I'll ask you to picture another kind of wall, only this one you've built around yourself. Like Fort Hamilton in its heyday, your wall is so imposing, heavily guarded, and densely constructed that no one from the outside world would dare attempt to enter or attack it. This wall keeps you safe. It guards your secrets. Although this wall you've constructed for safety and security protects you from judgment and shame, it simultaneously holds you prisoner, damning you to a life of isolation. The only safe way to venture beyond the wall is by leaving your true identity at the gates. Outside, your personality, mannerisms, opinions, and interests are false, designed to hide who you really are. Day after day, your disguised self grows lonelier and more exhausted. How long do you think you can keep this up? How many days, weeks, months, or years could you pretend to be someone you are not? For Dr. Judy Lively, the answer was 40 years. Four decades of living a double life, hiding her truth from nearly all of her friends, family, physicians, and love interests. Judy lived most of her life in pain and discomfort, behind a wall so impenetrable that no one was allowed inside. This is the story of how she opened the gates to her world and tells of the lessons we can all learn from her journey. It's mid-morning, early August. Sunlight enters through the sliding glass doors behind me, slowly filling the room. The walls and furniture, richly decked in dark tones, are slowly waking up to the light. Judy and I sit across from each other in my friend's living room in Lafayette, California, near Mount Diablo. The charming hillside house isn't far from the Kaiser Permanente Medical Center in Walnut Creek, where Judy worked for over 20 years as a surgeon and physician leader. Judy crosses her legs and folds her palms across her knees. Sitting next to her is her partner, soulmate and spouse, the love of her life. 2 months before Judy agreed to sit down with me, she retired as the physician in chief of the Diablo service area. The physician in chief is the most senior leadership position throughout the vast Diablo service area, with its 400 square mile catchment, three hospitals, and more than a dozen large medical office complexes. As physician in chief, Judy was responsible for the medical care of nearly 500,000 Kaiser Permanente members. Under Judy's leadership, the service area became a national leader in quality and patient satisfaction. The gap, the mess she inherited, and what she achieved was so massive that few objective observers would have predicted such a high degree of success despite her impressive resume. Trained at Johns Hopkins, Judy experienced a meteoric rise through the leadership ranks, first as chief of surgery, then assistant physician in chief, and ultimately the physician in chief. One of my first responsibilities when I was selected as the medical group CEO was to choose the PIC, the physician in chief for the Diablo service area. Selecting Judy was one of the best decisions I ever made. "Do you remember why I selected you for the job?" I asked her. She seemed caught off guard by the question. Judy leans back against the sofa, arms folded, and tells me she assumes it was because she was the most qualified candidate. That's true, but my choice was a bit more complicated than that. "When I interviewed you, do you recall that I asked you a really inappropriate question?" Once again, Judy appears unprepared for this line of inquiry and now looks a bit worried too. "No, I do not," she replies. "No, I asked you a question I had never asked anyone before and one I've never asked again. Of course, in retrospect, it was inappropriate and illegal for me to ask it, but I was new at my job." Judy's shaking her head, flummoxed. I hesitate briefly, then plunge ahead. "The question was this: if you had to choose between your job and your spouse, which would you pick?" Judy laughs uncomfortably. Her spouse is sitting beside her and scanning Judy's eyes intently, waiting for a response. "Well, what did I say?" Judy implores, never once breaking eye contact with me. "You told me that you would choose your job," I reply. "I've thought about this often, Judy, for nearly 20 years. I've replayed it 100 times in my mind. Why? Why did I make you answer this very personal question?" One logical answer would have been my own insecurity. I was a new CEO in charge of saving a sinking ship, and I didn't have much time to turn the organization's performance around. I knew it would take commitment and courage to fix what was broken, and I couldn't afford to select a leader who was anything short of all in. That reasoning led me to a second question. Why did I worry about this with Judy, but not the other leaders I selected at other medical centers around the same time? "I had every confidence you would do the job," I say, "but I needed to know if you wanted it. I needed a leader who was willing to sacrifice everything. I think I sensed something was happening in your life that could get in the way." Before I can say another word, Judy offers me forgiveness. "I get it," she says. "You had a problem to solve. You had an impossible job, and you needed someone who was willing to sacrifice everything to get the job done. That's what I did." Judy is merciful with me, and her forgiveness is generous. My question could have resulted in real harm, both to the organization, had Judy chosen her spouse, and I hadn't chosen her, but also to Judy. Even raising the issue could have caused her to doubt herself as a leader, doubt herself as a partner in marriage, and doubt that the organization that she loved truly had her back. Time seems to have healed any resentment I might have caused. Even if I experienced a little beginner's luck as CEO, I'm thankful my question didn't leave any permanent scars. By the time Judy's first term as physician chief ended in 2004, she was confident I would support a reappointment. She was right. In fact, I considered her my eventual successor. I was grooming her to become the next CEO of the Permanente Medical Group. But the year following her reappointment, Judy's ascent up the career ladder suddenly ended abruptly. She decided the time had come to blaze her own trail, one that others could follow. Her hope to provide a path for people in similar circumstances is the reason she's letting me share a story with you today. Judy's dad was a career military officer and a Southern Baptist minister. Accordingly, her family moved every couple of years. My mom was the classic army wife, Judy recalls. She lived at home and her job was to be my dad's counterpart in the military world as he ascended the hierarchy of the chaplaincy. She was brought up in the deep South. She's a classic Southern belle. Everything is proper. I think she's still annoyed that I don't wear dresses. This was the traditional military family in most ways, but not all. Judy says her story begins to congeal in the fourth grade when her family moves to Fort Hamilton in New York. Yes, that Fort Hamilton, the site of the wall. There, just outside the active duty military base, she recalls an experience she had in the basement of the housing complex with a group of similarly aged girls and boys, an experience that began to change how she saw herself. So we're all together in the basement and we were prepubescent, so there wasn't any sexual stuff. It was literally just, what do you got? I refer to this experience as, you show me yours and I'll show you mine. Prior to that experience, I didn't realize anatomy was different, that people were built differently. Growing up, Judy was an only child who saw only herself in the mirror. She lived in a God-fearing home where most questions about below-the-waist anatomy were strictly off-limits. And this is where Judy's lifelong secret began to take shape. It's where she first acquired a coping mechanism to deal with the fact that she wasn't like the other children. Judy was a girl living in a boy's body. She had male parts and was given a male birth name, Judson, Jud for short, but she felt no other genuine connection to her biological sex. She didn't feel like a boy. She had interest in dolls, her mother's clothes, and hanging out with other girls. At the same time, Judy also had a feeling, well, more like a fear, that God was always watching and judging her. When you're a boy growing up in a religious family, you're expected to be a boy. And so I remember getting to a point where I decided that my adaptive response was going to be a wall. I constructed a medieval castle wall, multiple feet thick and really tall. I was on one side, everyone else was on the other side. And the people on the other side were never going to know what I knew on my side of the wall. That's how young Judy's life of secrecy began. Throughout childhood and adolescence, she took on a very convincing male persona. It's common in the world of transgender females to adopt the normative concept of masculinity and to run with it at full speed. In addition to high school athletics and playing varsity sports, I'd go skydiving, parachuting, whitewater rafting, combat guns, and knife fighting, martial arts, you name it. In college, I was a varsity fencer, back in the days before girls were allowed to compete. I had a series of activities that allowed me to return to school and recount the very macho things I had done that weekend. In those days, Judy was simply doing her best to live up to everyone's expectation. She used the male front for protection, hoping it would prevent anyone from ever imagining the truth. Even now, as I sit across from Judy with her makeup tastefully applied, components of her male persona remain firmly intact. She doesn't deny it. Having lived as a man for so long, Judy is now an amalgamation of gender identities. The role of Jed remains an indelible part of her. So think back to that 1998 job interview and the inappropriate question I asked Judy, whom I knew as Jed at the time. I believe I sensed something beyond her impressive resume. Something didn't seem to fit. I'm convinced now that I observed a softer side, one that contrasted with a very aggressive, macho personality. At the time, I believe I needed a stop at nothing, take no prisoners candidate who wouldn't quit when the going got tough. And I knew the going would get tough. If my confusion about Judy was any indication, I can only imagine how difficult it must have been for her to be transgender in the 1970s and 80s. Back then, talking about her feelings wasn't an option. Coming out at a school filled with army brats wouldn't have been considered an act of bravery or vulnerability. It would have been suicide. Although she was aware that something didn't feel right about her body in middle school, Judy didn't explore her feelings until high school. She remembers one afternoon sneaking off to the mall after class and buying a pair of high heels under the guise of a love-struck boy shopping for his girlfriend. She tossed the shoes in the car, drove out to a field, and tried them on. That stuff was so dangerous, she tells me, and only done when I was 100% sure I could keep it private. That afternoon, alone in an empty field, Judy glanced down and admired the bright red pumps on her feet. She found a sturdy patch of dirt to walk about. She wobbled uncontrollably with each step. Nevertheless, she felt strong. She loved the way these shoes fit and how they looked. She felt pretty and tall. After a few more struts up and down the dirt patch, she recalls undoing the straps, grabbing the heels off her feet one at a time, and throwing them as far as she could into the tall grass. She put her tennis shoes back on, drove home to a family that greeted her as Judd, and went to bed with her secret. Throughout high school, Judy continued to earn top grades and varsity letters. Performing as Judd, she succeeded academically and athletically during undergraduate at William & Mary II. Then it came time to choose a medical school. Judy says she chose Johns Hopkins because it was a fast-track option that shortened the academic requirements by a year. It was only a coincidence, she tells me, that Johns Hopkins Hospital was the first institution in the United States to perform sex reassignment surgery. This groundbreaking medical work began in the early 1960s, years before the Stonewall riots in New York City sparked this country's LGBT rights movement. And because this work was so innovative and interesting, the pioneers of the surgical program at Hopkins often made their way out west to speak at plastic surgery meetings in San Francisco. Physicians from Stanford regularly hosted these doctors for departmental dinners in Palo Alto, where they discussed the newest procedures, surgical innovations, and, after a few drinks, the psychological challenges of their work. Doctors who had grown up wholly assured of their cisgender identity described to colleagues the shock of examining a beautiful female patient, only to discover she had a penis and testicles. To doctors of this era, all of them raised in a heteronormative society, the confusion was too much to bear. They each told stories about colleagues who suffered erectile dysfunction and intimacy problems as a consequence of these clinical interactions, even though no physician would admit to having such a problem himself. To Judy, a person experiencing gender dysphoria firsthand, there had never been an outlet for her feelings, no peers to share in or validate her confusion, and no reliable sources of information to which she could turn. She felt completely alone. All that changed during her second year of medical school. Fortunately for her, transgender patients regularly flowed in and out of the Hopkins medical system. The resident running the clinical service thought it'd be funny to subject me, the medical student, to doing a history and physical on a gender reassigned patient, Judy says, noting that she had no idea about the patient's gender identity. So the first physical exam I ever did turned out to have been on a post-op male to female transsexual. Prior to that point, I didn't really know words like transsexual. I had no concept of the terminology, but after the physical exam, the words came to mean something to me. Take a moment to appreciate the significance of this event for Judy. Beyond the sophomoric cruelty exhibited by the resident in charge, Judy was suddenly thrust into a moment of inner awakening. Coming out of that experience, she had not only the words, but also the power to understand and describe herself. This is language that American physicians are only now slowly and uneasily beginning to learn and apply in medical practice. Most physicians, like most Americans, were raised with simplistic ideas about sex and gender. They were taught to recognize two sexes, male and female, which align with two genders, man and woman. These traditional views remain wired into the physician culture through the medical terminology all doctors use. From the moment they turn on their computers, physicians encounter traditional gender norms and labels. For example, all typed entries into a patient's medical record begin with a basic rundown of the person's age, race, ethnicity, and sex. Male patient's chart might start, John Doe is a 44-year-old white male who presents with the chief complaint of leaving little room for 21st century nuance. In creating that preamble, the doctor would document the patient's sex by clicking either male or female from a pull-down menu. And that action has the power to generate another set of problems. Consider, for example, the electronic health record quagmire that can occur when physicians click female. With that selection, doctors are expected to enter information on menstrual histories or LMP, short for last menstrual period, for any patient over the age of 12. Now let's assume the patient is an adult who happened to have testes prior to undergoing gender reassignment surgery. Clearly, that person would never have had a period. However, that's not something the computer or physician culture is prepared to recognize. This is evidenced by the next set of computer prompts, which include a series of urgent alerts. The algorithm was created with the assumption that a premenopausal woman without a period must have either an unrecognized congenital anomaly or some potentially life-threatening disease that requires additional testing. Doctors of generations past could not have imagined a medical record or a professional discourse that included terms like transgender, gender nonconforming, or non-binary. Back in the days when physicians entered the exam room to provide medical care for Susan Smith or a John Johnson, they were able to make assumptions about the types of diseases they might treat and the type of language they would use. But many of today's physicians are literally at a loss for words. Medicine's training model, record-keeping templates, and long-lasting binary views leave doctors feeling confused, uncomfortable, and unprepared to care for patients who don't conform to yesterday's norms. Try to imagine how Judy must have felt, not just as a medical student, but as a patient going in for medical care. Nothing the doctor told her about her changing body matched her lived experiences or how she felt about herself. Long before there were books on gender-neutral parenting or bathroom debates in the halls of Congress or psychological discussions about the dangers of putting artificial limitations on gender, Judy had to figure it all out on her own. After Johns Hopkins, Judy Still, going by her male name, was accepted into surgical residency at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. There, during a rotation in the burn unit of the Metro Hospital, the hotshot, macho surgeon in the making met a woman unlike any other she had ever known. She was the head nurse of the operating room, Judy says, turning to the woman beside her on the sofa. Karen reaches for Judy's hand with a gentle grin as she recalls the man she first met in 1984. Even as a resident, he was the one that doctors brought the families to be operated on. His skills were top of the line. He was a well-respected doctor, and he was handsome too, Karen says, giggling. So I asked him out. The two fell quickly in love and were married a year later. With residency completed, they packed up and moved to Texas, where Judy entered the U.S. Army. It was there in October that she made the hardest and riskiest decision of her life. After living for 28 years inside a protective barrier, Judy stepped out from behind the wall and revealed her true self to Karen. It was a moment that would challenge Karen's outlook on her marriage and her life. That night, Karen came to a series of difficult realizations that her husband had been keeping a lifelong secret, that her husband was a woman, and that they were suddenly in a same-sex relationship. Karen could have understandably bolted right then and there. She had fallen in love with a macho man, and without warning, a woman stood before her, asking to be loved. Remembering back on that uncertain time, Karen explains, it was confusing and difficult, and we cried a lot. We fought sometimes. There were times when I just wanted my husband back. It was a raw, emotional time. It was also a scary time. They were in Texas. Judy was in active duty military. I was worried for his safety, Karen says. I was worried about what happened to his job and to us. So the first decision we made was that Texas was not the right place for us. By 1988, after moving around to several locations, the couple made their way to California. The Bay Area proved a much better place to build a new life, accepting that their love was greater than the sum of their bodily parts. Karen and Judy were accepted immediately into San Francisco's LGBT community. They began meeting other transgender people and establishing a support system made up of other couples whose stories resembled their own. But for Judy, life as a doctor remained a daily challenge. From the time she left the house in the morning until she returned at night, She had to be Judd, the masculine surgeon and rising physician leader. Those ongoing deceptions were more difficult than one might think. Imagine you walking down the hall and you need to go to the bathroom, Judy tells me. You see the men's and women's signs next to each other. Before you reach for one door or the other, you have to consciously remember which persona you are. I eventually got very good at knowing where all the unisex stalls were. Thinking about that for a second, every time you have to urinate at work, you must solve an intellectual puzzle. You must be vigilant and conscious of even your most instinctive thoughts while in front of your colleagues. Then driving home at the end of the day, you must shift from one frame of mind to another. Driving back to work the next morning, you must pivot and switch back into your macho personality once again. Think of all the energy that goes into switching personas back and forth every day, multiple times a day. But Judy, it was exhausting. Doctors are trained to consider the impact of stress on their patients' lives. They understand certain events can trigger anxiety, the death of a family member, the loss of a job. They compile facts about patients to reach the right medical diagnoses. But even if Judy's doctors had known about her struggles with gender identity, they could not have imagined the depth of the stress it caused her. In a medical culture that can only see black and white, the gray areas of Judy's life were invisible to her colleagues. She remained dedicated to her career and kept her persona intact. All this left her with little time to stabilize her shaky marriage. Karen was distraught, fearing what the pace and demands of Judy's work would mean, both for their relationship and for the professional happiness of the person she loved, the doctor everyone still knew as Judd. At the time, Judy was hell-bent on climbing the career ladder at any cost. She obtained an MBA knowing it would make her a better physician leader. She worked overtime, wanting to prove herself to her colleagues. Karen thinks Judy's career aspirations were motivated by inauthentic desires. It was his persona deciding for him. It was him wanting to prove once again that I am the ultimate macho male. And his path forward being a leader created a lot of problems for us. I really hated that he was continuing this farce. And I felt that at least if he stayed with surgery and decided to come out to his colleagues, they could remain a surgeon and avoid the public eye. But being in a high-level position would risk everything. Nevertheless, Judy continued in the role that Karen didn't want her to pursue and played the role that Karen didn't want her to play. As a result, she worked extremely hard to achieve the impossible in the Diablo service area and succeeded year after year. In hospitals, everyone respects someone like Judd, the confident surgeon with exacting standards and great clinical instincts. They trust him and rarely follow his lead. Physician culture is rife with this archetype. As CEO, I love Judd, the fearless and tireless leader. What Judd couldn't be sure of was how people would respond to Judy if they ever met her. In 2002, Judy began visiting a therapist who confirmed she was transgender, something Judy had known since she first learned the term in medical school. Then with Karen's support and encouragement, Judy began taking female hormones. At the time, she was the extent of Judy's transition. Clinics dedicated to performing surgery for male to female patients require them to live as a woman openly for an entire year before scheduling the procedure. The reasoning is twofold. First, since the operation is irreversible, doctors want the person to be 100% certain about proceeding. The same is true about irreversibility of cosmetic surgery, yet physicians have no qualms about moving forward quickly. The second reason they impose this requirement reflects the beliefs of physician culture. Doctors experience cognitive dissonance when the amputation of a penis isn't a matter of necessity, but choice. In the absence of cancer or gangrene or a life-threatening illness, doctors are reluctant to remove what they perceive to be normal anatomy. Physicians believe patients must be protected from their emotions, spared from making a rash and illogical decision. They have difficulty understanding why someone would undergo the surgery and worry they will regret it unless given time to reconsider. The sense of cultural discomfort spills over in the operating room, where I've heard attending physicians and assisting surgical residents wryly comment, It's a waste to have to throw out a completely good penis. His attempts at humor, even unfunny ones, reveal the depths of discomfort physicians experience when addressing complicated issues surrounding sex and gender. Before proceeding with the transition, there was one more task Judy needed to complete, informing the person to whom she reported, and that was me. One day in 2005, we took the elevator from the second floor boardroom to my office on the 19th and sat down as evening dawned in Oakland. I listened as Judy described to me in detail the facts of her gender identity and her plan to undergo gender affirmation surgery. She assured me she could still do the job as physician in chief and do it well, but she'd be willing to resign if that was my preference. I told her that keeping her in the role was a high priority for me. I was confident her colleagues and patients would accept her decision. She was equally optimistic, but told me that one more thing about her future at Kaiser Permanente. I didn't want to go any further up the ladder, Judy remembers. I didn't want to take the chances that someone would discount or dismiss the organization because of my gender transition. I was worried that if I were ever to become the face of the organization, that I might hurt Kaiser Permanente. And it was a very conscious decision. I didn't want to do anything that would ever hurt KP. Though I understood her rationale, the news came as a shock. My respect for her expertise and all she had accomplished had made me oblivious to some basic truths about physician culture and American society's view on sexuality and gender identity. Having trained in the Bay Area and taken care of dozens of patients undergoing gender reassignment surgery during my residency, I was more comfortable with Judy's decision than most. Today, 6 in 10 Americans say they've become more supportive towards transgender rights compared to their views of 5 years ago. 15 years back, acceptance was much harder to come by. And besides, it's one thing to profess acceptance and another to act in ways different from your implicit biases and internal emotional reactions. Judy's physical appearance, voice, and mannerisms would be foreign to her colleagues and potentially problematic for many. I tell Judy that I disagreed with her decision to halt her career ascent because I had never once seen her fail. I knew she'd be a remarkably successful CEO, despite how some people might respond. I also knew I wasn't going to be successful in reversing her decision. We then talked about the process by which she would tell others, both inside and outside Kaiser Permanente. Judy had planned meticulously for every possible reaction and contingency, something she felt was necessary to protect the organization. Her preference was to inform her colleagues and the world with Karen by her side. I supported her plan. Here's how the San Francisco Chronicle described Judy's announcement in 2005. Dr. Judson Lively, a surgeon and one of Kaiser Permanente's leading Bay Area administrators, stood nervously before 100 colleagues in a Walnut Creek conference room Tuesday and told them it was no accident there were butterflies on his black tie. Lively told them a fable that was in essence the story of his life, of being trapped inside the body of another, yearning for a transformation to be set free. I stand here before you to inform you of something that I've kept hidden from the world and virtually everyone else, with the exception of my family, for my entire life. Lively, flanked by his wife and daughter, told the hushed crowd, I'm 48 years old. For over 40 years, I have known that I am a transsexual woman. My heart and soul really are those of a woman. Nearly all of Judy's colleagues and patients took the news in stride. I sent 700 letters to coworkers before the announcement, Judy says. I reached out to 100 patients, to all the people I was following post-op, peri-op, or pre-op. Patients for whom I was actively involved in their care. I went to their homes and had a private conversation in their living rooms to tell them. And if they wanted, I would transition their care to another physician who I would handpick for clinical excellence. Zero patients chose to bail. Zero. Unsure whether the hardest part was really over, she prepared those around her in the Diablo service area for what might become a public spectacle. She held meetings with all the staff in her medical center. She brought in a panel of experts to describe the process of transition and answer questions. She made sure the nurses and receptionists in the surgery department were comfortable talking about the decision and could answer any questions that patients might have. Throughout 2005, Judy continued to provide care as a surgeon while performing her duties as physician in chief. She underwent her surgical transition in 2006. I suspect the average male gets some kind of weird heebie-jeebies when he thinks about castration, you know, losing a penis or testes. But I never had that anxiety, Judy explains. They were never mine to begin with. So I went into surgery not remotely worried that I was going to somehow experience a sense of loss, because I never felt they were part of me anyway. After Judy's announcement and surgery, she returned to work, having shed the male persona she'd worked so hard to cultivate. She didn't return to her clinical leadership roles as a wholly new person, rather as the person she kept hidden behind the wall her entire life. Judy's work-life balance improved, as did her relationship with Karen. There were the big picture benefits of finding acceptance and getting the support of her colleagues. After her wall came down, Judy no longer dreaded that her secret would be discovered. There were also the smaller, but no less important benefits that many people might take for granted. To starters, Judy began using the women's bathroom without a second thought. In time, she and Karen settled into their new lives together, more confident in their love and sure of the future. Judy remained physician in chief for a third term, leading the medical center to ever higher levels of quality and service performance. When Judy retired in 2017, the physicians in her medical center threw a massive gala in her honor. That year, she and Karen moved to a beautiful, quiet home on the western slope of the Sierra foothills.
As a reminder to listeners, this episode is available on our website, fixinghealthcarepodcast.com, and in all podcast apps, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. If you like the show, please rate it 5 stars and share it with your friends and family. To submit a question or comment to the host, please visit the contact page on our website or send us a message on LinkedIn, Twitter, or Facebook. Thank you for listening and have a great day.